Good afternoon and welcome to today's broadcast of Men's Magazines. I'm your host, Philip Varell. Today's readings, as always, will be suitable for both ladies and gentlemen. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. And we're going to get into the Men's Journal magazine. An article titled The Art of Change, a wave of new artists and designers is grappling with the looming environmental crisis and transforming the way we see the wild world. This put together by Mary Ann Potts. All good art, as the adage goes, is political. From Diego Rivera to Pablo Picasso to Walker Evans to Banksy, artists have never shied away from creating works with political points of view. Now they're casting their gaze on perhaps the single greatest threat to humankind, global climate change. In the coming generation, coastal cities will need to grapple with sea level rises as polar ice caps melt. Fresh water shortages could create waves of refugees, and changes to the climate, combined with the increasing effects of human influence on the environment, could mean the extinction of up to 1 million species. It's a sobering time, to say the least. But for this new collection of painters, photographers, designers, and graphic artists, it's also an opportunity to make new work that not only strikes an emotional chord, but persuades viewers into action. That is to say, to create work with political ends. Here are the artists doing their best to make sense of the coming environmental disasters and spur the world into positive change. So first of all, we have Zaria Foreman, and Zaria is Z-A-R-I-A, capturing the beauty of polar ice before it's too late. Over the last decade, Brooklyn artist Zaria Foreman has become renowned for her hyper-realistic drawings of water in dramatic transitions, waves crashing on the beach, rainstorms thrashing the sea, icebergs shimmering as they melt. There was only one problem. At first, I was actually terrified to draw ice, she says. I didn't think it was possible to render in my chosen medium. That's a valid concern, considering that Foreman uses pastels, basically colored chalk. Today, though, she's finished dozens of stunning images of glaciers, thanks to numerous trips to the polar regions. It was her first trip to the Arctic in 2007 that got her interested in the subject. Based in Greenland for a month, she ventured out into the ice fields each day where the people she encountered, scientists, reporters, government officials, were already focused on how the landscape was changing. Vast fjords were not freezing as they once did, which impacted the locals' subsistence hunting. It opened my eyes to the climate crisis, she says, and it instilled in me a need to play a part in helping to solve it. It wasn't until 2012, however, that Foreman turned her creative energies back to ice. She returned to Greenland to lead an expedition honoring her recently deceased mother, an artist herself. I decided it was time to face my fear, she says, and I've been drawing ice ever since. For her work, Foreman spends at least a month on location, making sketches and taking thousands of photographs before sitting down when she returns home to draw large-scale interpretations of the photos. The meticulous drawings can take upwards of 5 months to complete. That translates into a lot of time in the studio and in the field. Foreman has trekked on a glacier with a Greenlandic shaman, climbed through an ice cave in Norway's Svalbard archipelago, and flown with NASA scientists over areas of Antarctica where rescue would have been nearly impossible. She's also been to the Maldives, the lowest, flattest country in the world, because melting ice leads to rising seas. Foreman wants her art, which has been displayed in museums, U.S. embassies, and NATO's headquarters in Brussels, to help people connect emotionally to places that are on the front lines of climate change. I choose to convey the beauty as opposed to the devastation of threatened places, she says, because I want to inspire the viewer into positive action, not paralyze them with fear. And that was the first artist. That was Zaria Foreman. Next up, we have Michael Comte, and it's C-O-M-T-E. A fashion photographer returns to his outdoor roots. A dozen years ago, Michael Comte was at the peak of his career as one of the most successful fashion and portrait photographers in the world. His work appeared in practically every glossy magazine and featured a glowing roster of A-list celebrities and models, including Sophia Loren, Cindy Crawford, and Tina Turner. But he yearned to return to his roots as a painter and sculptor and focus on the state of the natural world, particularly its ice. My childhood outdoors had a very large impact on my life, says Comte, who was an avid skier and mountain climber growing up in Zurich. In 1986, he spent nearly a year in the Himalayas, where he trekked to some of the world's most beautiful glaciers, occasionally photographing them by dangling from a hang glider. He even climbed on K2 and made it to Camp 3 at 23,000 feet. I was a very committed mountain climber until one of my very closest friends got killed, he says. Then I took it more as an exploration than as a sport. Comte's life of icy landscapes was sparked by the first aerial images of Swiss glaciers taken in 1914. His grandfather, Alfred, was a co-founder of Swiss Air, and the photos were shot by Alfred's co-pilot. Many of those glaciers have changed drastically, including St. Moritz's Roseg Glacier, which Comte still visits regularly. Glaciers are not white anymore in the summer, he says. They are mostly gray from all of the carbon output. He used this idea in one of his most recent works, a series of paintings of discolored glaciers. Reinventing himself professionally was not easy. Comte was so established as a photographer that he had to submit his work anonymously to museums to help it get accepted. It worked. His first major installation, Light, was at the Maxi Museum of Modern Art in Rome in 2017. It was an homage to glacial landscapes in Switzerland, the Himalayas, Canada, Africa, and Norway through large sculptures, photos, video installations, projections, and even many ice mountains melting away in the gallery. Then came Black Light, White Light in Milan, which he created Glacier Lake, a reflecting pool filled with crinkled silver thermal blankets resembling ice chunks. A subsequent, more ambitious project used those blankets to cover and protect real glaciers in summer. It was the beginning of an ongoing shift from museum work to getting his art and his viewers out into the wild where they can do something. The only way we can make change is to get actively involved, says Comte. Then you really start seeing what is happening. All right, that second artist was Michael Comte. Next, we have Alexis Rockman, a surreal take on human influences. There is nothing more compelling and alarming than human history and how it has affected the rest of life on Earth, says New York painter Alexis Rockman, whose work has been focused on environmental change since 1995. Geology, human engineering, and disease have all had a hand in our evolution as a species and shaped our world. His recent touring exhibition, The Great Lakes Cycle, dramatizes how the Great Lakes, which holds 20% of the Earth's surface fresh water, are being impacted by human activity. Forces of change, for example, is a composite of significant places and people from Great Lakes history, from the Niagara River to the invasive tree of heaven. The great disruptor E. coli is presented as a tentacled, monstrous kraken that bursts from the river's bottom, says Rockman. It alludes to the powerful forces that often seem invisible to us. All right, that third artist was Alexis Rockman. Next, we have Eve Mosher. visualizing a watery world. When Eve Mosier chalked a blue line across New York City in 2007, she was full of optimism. Marking the ground in areas that were 10 feet above sea level showed where flooding could reach as sea levels rose and supercharged storms hit. The idea was to show urban residents how climate change would impact their lives and inspire positive action. But in 2012, when Hurricane Sandy flooded parts of New York City, high water line seemed prophetic. The conceptual artist has now taken that idea to other cities, including Miami and Bristol, England. Artists can help people imagine and move forward, says Mosier. We are at risk of going extinct. We need to have radical courage about what's possible to reimagine the future. All right. That artist was Eve Mosier. Next up, we have Joel Sartore, documenting the world's disappearing species. Over the last 13 years, Joel Sartore, a photographer for National Geographic, has made images of 10,000 of the roughly 15,000 species living in zoos and nature preserves around the world. But these are no ordinary photos. For each animal, he uses a mobile studio setup, capturing them on a white or black background. This is done to level the playing field, as he says, in terms of size. The mouse is every bit as important as an elephant, says Sartore. The massive effort is part of his photo arc project that will ultimately be a 25-year odyssey to photograph every species living in human care, documenting the world's biodiversity before it disappears. It's important for people to understand that as these animals go away, so will we, says Sartore, who estimates that 50% of the creatures he shoots are on the brink of extinction. This is the last chance they have to be heard before they go out of existence. He has now traveled to 50 countries and shot everything from a critically endangered black rhinoceros to a clouded leopard to the black and white spitting cobra. You have to wear a face shield so you don't get venom spit into your eyes, he says. Because the animals were often born in captivity and cared for by humans, they are generally cooperative. Chimps are the hardest by far, Sartore says. I still don't have a good picture of adult chimps, really. They're smart, they're fast, they're strong, and they're not afraid of anything. Another challenge, giant manta rays. I haven't figured them out yet, but I've got plenty of stuff to do in the meantime, he says. With changes to the Endangered Species Act in August, which included weakening protections under the pretense of lifting regulatory burdens, Sartore's work feels more urgent than ever. You can't doom half of all biodiversity to extinction and not think that it will affect humanity, he says. All right, that artist was Joel Sartore, documenting the world's disappearing species. Next up, we have John Gerard, using computer graphics to visualize a new era. You may not know it, but Spindletop, Texas, changed the world. It was the site of the first major oil find in the U.S., the Lucas Gusher, in 1901. It produced more oil in one day than the rest of the world's oil fields combined. Its discovery is also credited for launching the modern petroleum age, leading to gasoline-fueled cars, oils for heating homes, petroleum plastics, and yes, increased greenhouse gas emissions. Irish conceptual artist John Gerard, whose work often focuses on computer-generated images and simulations, brought this pivotal site out of obscurity with his piece Western Flag. The CGI video, which debuted on a museum screen in 2017, transforms an oil derrick in Spindletop into a black smoke flag burning from a pole in the ground. The work has been brought to other locations via video screen installations, like the one in California's Coachella Valley. One of the greatest legacies of the 20th century is not just population explosion or better living standards, but vastly raised carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, says Gerard. Here, a new flag attempts to give this invisible gas, this international risk, an image, a way to represent itself. I like to think of it as a flag for a new kind of world order. All right, next we have Justin Bryce Guariglia, G-U-A-R-I-G-L-I-A, Guariglia. Bold messages for a warming planet. This past Earth Day, April 22nd, a series of dire warnings came to the courtyard of Somerset House in London. 9 solar-powered roadwork signs displayed messages curated by artist Justin Bryce Guariglia. The words were from poets, philosophers, and some of today's strongest voices in the climate change discussion. 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg and eco-theorist Timothy Morton, among others. My show is meant to give us a language to rethink our relationship with the natural world, says Guariglia. The impact of our modern civilization is like an asteroid striking the planet. The New York City artist first got the idea to use roadwork signs while waiting outside New York City's Holland Tunnel. He realized they were a great way to pass along a note of caution. It's hard to say if my work has any real influence over decision-making, says Guariglia. What I do know is that the work is getting people's attention and getting the public to think and talk about these extremely urgent issues, an important first step to solving these problems. And there's a road sign below here, below the article. It says, "Goodbye, Arctic Ice." All right, and that was Justin Bryce Guariglia, Bold Messages for a Warming Planet. And that pretty much covers the article there on our artists and their thoughts on climate change. And that was called The Art of Change. That's put together by Marianne Potts from the Men's Journal magazine. From the GQ magazine, we go to the Fix section on health, and it's titled The Radical Wellness of Pro Skater Alex Olsen. The mind behind coveted fashion label Bianca Shandone spends 2 hours in the morning practicing yoga and meditation, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. This is put together by Noah Johnson. Alex Olsen comes out of nowhere. I'm waiting on the sidewalk in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, where we agreed to meet for breakfast, expecting to see him roll up on a bike or behind the wheel of his Mitsubishi Delica minivan. Instead, he appears silently on a mini skateboard with big, soft cruiser wheels as a blur of hair and limbs flying off the street. The scion of legendary skate punk Steve Olsen, Alex is one of the few second-generation professional skateboarders. He skates for Nike and his own successful board company, 917. But these days, you're just as likely to see him surfing on Long Island or DJing a club on Avenue C, or maybe shopping for medicinal herbs at an Indian grocery store called Dual Spices, as you are to see him in Thrasher. Olsen's various curiosities have led him down quite a few different paths with and without his skateboard. He also runs a small but highly sought-after fashion label called Bianca Shandone, which makes limited runs of graphic tees, hoodies, and sportswear that sell out quickly. He's an insatiable dabbler, approaching every new project with the intensity and focus of a first-year med student. He's been skateboarding since he was 12, and now Olsen has become a voracious consumer of all things related to mindfulness and spiritual betterment, a self-taught guru on his quest to feel better and make the world a better place. But he would never put it that way. He's just curious and deep in the wellness rabbit holes of YouTube and Instagram. You'd think that would be enough to keep Olsen occupied most days and grounded in some kind of corporate reality, but not so much. "I'm just like a bag blowing in the wind," he tells me. A chiseled Jesus with an aggro edge. Today he's wearing a vintage army jacket, faded jeans, and black woven leather shoes that resemble Mexican huaraches. It's fall in New York, but he's got a Florida tan. I picked the one easy place in the neighborhood where I thought we'd be able to chat in peace, but I soon realized that I'd made a crucial mistake. Olson is vegan. Anyone who follows him on Instagram, where he obsessively reposts extremely crunchy natural food and medicine memes, knows that. Nothing at this bistro is made without butter. But Olson perks up when the server tells us that the place has oat milk, which is enough to hold us over in the form of a couple of Americanos. Whenever I post any of that stuff, he says, of the Instagram stories he often shares, which are like Russian propaganda for the Iran set, it's more just for awareness. This may be true. This may be false. It's bringing attention. You can decide. You can decide about the benefits of cupping, fasting, and colon cleansing. But Olson has made his decision. I want to try to squeeze out as much whatever, as many years of skateboarding as I can, he tells me. I just want to feel good. Olson is 33 now, but, he says, a culmination of events that occurred around the time he turned 30 led him to a few major lifestyle changes. He lost his grandmother and his close friend, fellow pro skater Dylan Reeder, in the same year. Seeing Dylan go through cancer and stuff, you're just like, okay, we need to be healthier, says Olson. So he watched the documentaries Cowspiracy and What the Health. He read Meat is for Pussies by Cro-Mags singer John Joseph. I read that and I was like, damn, I need to do this. Olson is the kind of person who isn't satisfied by conventional answers. I ask, for example, if he ever takes Advil or other over-the-counter medicine. Frick no, he says. His cure for a headache? Eat 10 almonds. He drinks only distilled tap water, to which he adds his own minerals. It's crazy how much better it tastes, he says. Lately, he's been trying to get into an Ayurvedic diet, eating whole foods at set times according to doshas, different kinds of energies circulating in your body. Around the same time he was starting to tweak his diet, Olson hurt his ankle badly on a trip with the Nike skate team. He tried physical therapy and personal trainers, but didn't feel like he was making much progress. So he signed up for a one-month trial at the Woom Center, that's W-O-O-M, on Bowery in New York City. Woom is not like your typical neighborhood yoga spot, but with a futuristic flavor for technology, according to his website, that includes 3D sound baths and projected visual installations. It's very new agey, Olson says. I was just like, all right, I'm going to immerse myself in this yoga and see what happens if I apply myself for a month. After 5 days a week for a month, Olson says his ankle felt strong and, perhaps more important, his mind felt clear. For all its new aginess, he liked that Woom put an emphasis on meditation and encouraged chanting Om. Then one day a friend told him about Wim Hof. I think everyone knows who Wim Hof is at this point, Olson tells me. For those like me who didn't, Wim Hof, a.k.a. the Iceman, is a Dutch guy who hangs out while mostly nude on iceberg, plays guitar, runs marathons barefoot in the snow, and swims in frigid waters. Hof believes that you can train yourself to control your body through breathing in order to suppress pain, strengthen your immune system, and elevate your mood. The Wim Hof method combines breathing exercises with exposure to cold, often in the form of icy showers. It's all about controlling your heart rate with your breath and having them sync, Olson says. It's so cold that you have nothing to focus on but that one thing. There's no other thought, which I think is really the hardest thing with meditation. Olson completed 2 Wim Hof courses online but skipped a final lesson, like, go walk in the snow in the mountains. I'm like, who the frick has that? I mean, yeah, we have snow, but I don't have a freaking cold spring that I can jump into. Wim Hof added new dimensions to Olson's yoga practice, which he had been only doing on and off, and it was also a starting point on a journey through different realms of Eastern spirituality and meditation. He did Nali Kriya, a stomach-contorting breathing practice that is meant to squeeze your organs to rinse them out. He practiced Kundalini yoga, an intense style that incorporates seated meditation with long, melodic, chanted mantras and dynamic movements. That got him into holotropic breathwork, a 60-minute series of forced exhalations without pause. I fully hallucinated doing holotropic, Olson says. I know when you hear that, you're like, okay, bullshit. But you hyperventilate for 15 minutes, basically. I was seeing colors, and I was definitely like, I'm not where I'm supposed to be. Where Olson is headed with all of this, beyond a longer, more productive skate career and surfing faster waves, is anyone's guess. There is no end to this journey for him. He describes it like moving out of your parents' house. You find a home, you start to fill it with your own furniture, your own ideas about how to be in the world. It's just where you put your intentions, he says. These days, his morning practice is devoted to yoga, breathing, and meditation, which takes about 2 hours. What strikes me most about Olson's always evolving regimen is his capacity for learning and trusting new things. I think it's just being kind of open, he tells me. Like Bruce Lee says, be like water. You know what I mean? You can take any form if you pour yourself into it. And that article was titled The Radical Wellness. And that was put together by Noah Johnson. He's GQ's style editor. And that was, of course, from the GQ magazine. Now from the Esquire magazine, we have More Camel. More Camel. Camel hair, the super soft, super warm material once confined to coats, is finally making the leap to some beautifully tailored jackets. If you've come across camel hair before, chances are it was in one of those all-enveloping polo coats favored by suit and tie guys in the teeth of a New York winter. That's because camel hair is ridiculously warm. But camel hair is also insanely soft, great for coats, but why stop there? This season, the Italian brand Style Latino has created a range of tweedy jackets in 100% camel hair that bring the fabric out of the cold and into your wardrobe in a much bigger way. They're expertly tailored. They should be. Founder Vincenzo Attolini is the grandson of the Vincenzo Attolini, the tailor wildly hailed as the progenitor of the butter-soft Neapolitan style of tailoring, and they balance a rough hewn look with all the comfort of cashmere. You couldn't layer there three at a time, as we did here, but, and they have a picture of three jackets all intertwined together. But you just might want to do that. And More Camel, More Camel. That was put together by Nick Sullivan from the Esquire magazine. And we're getting close to the midpoint of today's show. I do want to remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And I'm Philip Varellan, your host today for Men's Magazines. I also want to remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. All right, now from the Men's Health magazine, we get the shady past and bright future of self-help's new superstar. Best-selling books, problematic blog posts, so many F-blank CKSs not given. Mark Manson's Lesson in Reinvention, and this is by Lauren Larson. There are a lot of reasons to listen to Mark Manson. He has the unvarnished wisdom of a bartender in a fishing town, for one thing. With his 2016 mega bestseller, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F-blank CK, Manson set out to contradict everything all the other self-help books were saying. If other self-help books say you're special, I'm going to write a chapter called You're Not Special. If other self-help books tell you to believe in yourself, I'm going to tell you not to believe in yourself. If other self-help books tell you just say yes, I'm going to write a chapter that says just say no. The Subtle Art has sold more than 6 million copies, and Manson's recent follow-up, Everything is F-blank-C-K-E-D, was on the bestseller list for 13 weeks. His blog, markmanson.net, boasts more than 1 million monthly readers with 500,000 paid subscribers. Still, Manson has an aura of approachability. It could be his soft, friendly-looking features or the way he seems comfortable in every chair, even when he's on stage. It could be the swearing. At first, I think the F-U-C-K-S's sound a little forced in the context of his latest book titles, like a kid who swears because he knows it's going to get a rise out of his mom. But the curse words become more frequent when Manson is talking passionately about something and less frequent when he's considering every word. He's just a swearer. In his books, Manson, 35, flays himself. The subtle art, in particular, draws heavily on his personal highs and lows. Some moments are funny and some are unexpectedly gutting, as when he describes his friend Josh's drowning when Manson was a teenager. Josh's death marks the clearest before-after point I can identify in my life. Pre-tragedy, I was inhibited, unambitious, forever obsessed, and confined by what I imagined the world might be thinking of me, Manson writes. Post-tragedy, I morphed into a new person, responsible, curious, hardworking. I still had my insecurities and my baggage, as we always do, but now I gave a frick about something more important than my insecurities and my baggage. It's feeling speak, but it's anchored by raw storytelling and the occasional F-U-C-K. Everything is F-blank-C-K-E-D is less moored to Manson's own experiences than the subtle art. But in the former, he cushions his philosophies in yarns. The book opens with a story of a Holocaust heroism. Not long ago, Manson read a review of Everything is F-blank-C-K-E-D that described him along the lines of a local drunk who spent too much time in the philosophy section at the bookstore. He was unruffled by the review. I read that and I'm like, that's pretty accurate. Strikingly, Manson's books appeal to both men and women who have historically been shuttled into separate lanes by the self-help industry. Men self-improved by getting swole or getting rich, and women self-improved by fighting husbands and laying out all those husbands' work outfits for the week on Sunday night. Manson estimates that his events audiences are 2/3 female and 1/3 male, but he says that men are way more likely to come up to him afterward to tell him how he's changed their lives. My most fervent fans are always guys. I'm probably one of 4 authors that they really like, he says. He explains that besides publishing books about making money, as well as a wave of creepy pickup books in the aughts, the self-help industry hasn't really found a way to address men. It's not that men aren't interested in achieving emotional maturity or distilling their values, Manson adds. It's just that when most writers hold forth on those subjects, they kick a masculinity tripwire. There's still a stigma attached to men discussing their mental health and, more nebulously, their feelings. Manson is unnervingly well-read in the works of the industry's old vanguard. He's able to summarize and belittle entire bodies of work in a single sentence. He's good. He's really, really good, he says of life coach and fellow mega author Tony Robbins. But with that many people, meaning with an audience that far-ranging, you're going to screw some up. Manson studied how Robbins buried advice about needs and values in business advice, and he saw how the pickup books did the same thing with romantic advice. I think if there's been a breakthrough in my work, Manson says, it's that I have found a way to appeal to a lot of men, to make it okay for them to read a book that talks about feelings and values and relationships without also alienating women. There are plenty of self-help writers with accessible voices and good stories who don't alienate women, but none of them have Manson's audience. What sets him apart is his ability to cast himself as the clear-eyed voice of reason in an industry of nuts. He did it recently with the help industry, and he did it years ago with the pickup artist community. And that is perhaps the most compelling reason to listen to Mark Manson. At a time when male comebacks seem unlikely, even impossible, he has managed to successfully rebrand from professional bad dude to professional good dude. As of 2005, Manson was, in his words, a poor, sexless neophyte. That was the year he discovered The Game, a pickup artist manifesto from writer Neil Strauss, the personification of a swipe left on Tinder. Manson became a disciple of the pickup artist community, then quickly rose to a sort of nerd regency. Throughout his childhood in Austin and college in Boston, Manson played a lot of video games. When he had to choose a pseudonym for online pickup artist forums, his nom de douche, he resurrected his gamer name, Entropy. He spent the next 7 years traveling, delivering dating advice on his now-defunct blog, and working as a wingman for hire for the kind of guys who would seek out a wingman for hire. He charged clients about $800 a day. Manson volunteers that he began his career in dating and relationship advice, but not that he actually was a pickup artist. When I asked direct questions about that period, though, he answers them candidly and casually. I searched for cached pages from Manson's old website, postmasculine.com, and I was surprised at the Neil Straussness of some of his early posts. On his blog, he wrote at length about subjects such as ethics, bride at her bachelorette party. In hindsight, pursuing her was wrong. And how to pick up girls in college, a post Manson published in 2008. As soon as you can tell a girl is attracted to you, make a move on her. Girls at college parties are drunk, inexperienced, stressed out, and many of them are looking to hook up. There's no place for subtlety here, Manson wrote. You can kiss them within minutes of meeting them. If you move things fast physically and get them horny, you can get them in the bedroom within 30 minutes. When I mentioned this post to Manson, he sounds so uncomfortable that I apologize. I definitely wrote something like that, and it's definitely making me cringe a little bit right now, he says. I have a number of guy friends that I met in that community, and they've moved on. Nobody thinks about it anymore. But every once in a while, I'll have a conversation with one of those friends and be like, I can't believe we did that, you know? And they're like, yeah, but we grew a lot and we matured a lot. And it's like, yeah, but we did a lot of kind of shady shit too. He's like, yeah, kind of. There's definitely conflicted feelings about it. I think overall, for most of the men, it was probably a net positive. Another deleted post heralds his exit from that milieu. After spending 5 years in the pickup artist community, I've taken my leave, Manson wrote on September 21st, 2010. He then began repudiating pickup artistry more frequently and offered advice for transitioning to civilian life. He also appeared on various blogs, did AMAs on Reddit, and devoted a blog post to dismantling The Game. Now, I'm not here to start a smear campaign, Manson wrote of Strauss in 2010 after an introduction in which he expressed his gratitude to the writer for exposing him to the idea that it's possible for any man to improve in matters of seduction. But everyone I've met who lived in that house, Project Hollywood, Strauss's pickup artist mothership, has come away with a bad taste in their mouth, and many of them openly don't like the guy. You be the judge, he went on. Pickup artist advice up until about 2007 or so was, and I'm being brutally honest here, horrible, completely ineffective at best, and outright manipulative and misleading at worst. He decried The Game as a marvel of marketing, a dating get-rich-quick scam. He launched the single biggest product launch in internet marketing history at the time, bringing in over $11 million, Manson wrote. He then launched his business Style Life, which has over 40,000 members, each paying $40 a month. You sure it wasn't a sales job? On his own website, Manson touts his $48 annual subscription in a Wikipedia-like appeal. I'm an independent writer. What that means is that I'm not under contract at a magazine or newspaper. I'm not beholden to some overbearing editor, publisher, and I'm certainly not whoring myself out to some big media conglomerate. I have you, my readers, people who love what I do enough that they're willing to help me keep being able to do it. In July 2011, Manson self-published The Book Models, a comprehensive guide to attracting women on Amazon and on his website. The following year, he released a revised edition calling it Models, Attract Women Through Honesty. In a foreword to the revision, he explained that he wanted to address consent more directly. This was always implied in earlier versions of the book he wrote, but after being horrified at some of the emails I get from men and how they interpret the book, I've decided to be more explicit about this. Manson has left Entropy behind. His old blog posts were accompanied by a photo of a slimmer, younger Mark Manson, eyes very green, but a little dead, a smug half-smile on his lips. Now the About Me section of markmanson.net features a photo of him in a light blue button-up shirt, arms crossed in front of him. He looks healthy and corporate and not at all entropic. He lives in New York with his wife, Fernanda. He did meet her in a nightclub, he says, but he approached her as a civilian. I had no line, he recalls. It was, "Hi, I'm Mark." Beyond being important from a personal development standpoint, Manson's well-engineered departure from the pickup artist community was a prototype for the rest of his professional life. He is a serial disruptor, and if there's one thing he can teach us, it's how to make yourself the face of an industry's aha moment. Manson was a welcome upstart among the old woo-woo institutions. Dale Carnegie, of the very old vanguard, gave us tips in the 1936s how to win friends and influence people, which is still in circulation. Gentle Earth, Uncle Eckhart Tolle encouraged us to quell the damaging, ego-driven thought patterns, keeping us from finding our true purpose. The Secrets, Rhonda Byrne suggested that single people sleep on one side of the bed and use only half the space in their closets. It will be as though they have already found the perfect partner, she reasoned, and then the universe will send the perfect partner their way. I know I'm a self-development blogger, and I'm supposed to keep everything light and airy and full of poop jokes, but frick that, I hate it. It's an awful book, Manson wrote of The Secret in 2015. His campaign was one of radical change, and Byrne was his counterpoint. He argued that her philosophy of all-the-time positive thinking was, in fact, very destructive. "Call me crazy," he wrote, "but I believe that changing and improving your life requires destroying a part of yourself and replacing it with a newer, better part of yourself. It is therefore, by definition, a painful process full of anxiety." Nobody called him crazy. Manson rejected the industry's emphasis on promising readers concrete steps toward self-improvement. These action items are often arbitrary and unscientific, but they're very seductive. My publisher really wanted me to put those in there, and I told him, absolutely not. They don't work. I don't want to write them, Manson says. Some conventional self-help people read the book and were like, there's nothing actionable in here, so this is a waste of time. Instead of giving readers a step-by-step roadmap to a perfect life, he recommends that they learn how to accept life's imperfections. If other self-help books are crash diets, then Manson's is the tough love nutritionist, sitting us down and telling us to stop eating Pop-Tarts. I say, 30 days is not enough. You have to manage your relationship with the Pop-Tart for the rest of your life. It's an unsexy philosophy, delivered by a man whose professional qualifications amount to, "I've had a blog for a while." People are like, "Why should I listen to you?" He says, I'm like, "I don't know. Don't. I'm not going to stand up here and say that I've got it all figured out. Here are my 18 degrees. I just started writing about my problems and my issues and how I dealt with them, and people liked it and kept asking me to write more." But Manson feels no less qualified to proselytize than any other industry kingpin is. Rather, he views his ability to recognize when he's out of his depth as a strength. He's the fun aunt of life advice. He's also a great peacetime babysitter, up for changing the occasional diaper. But when things get really shitty, he hands us off to the people who know best. He tells me that a self-help writer can either choose to be honest about what he doesn't know or delude himself into thinking that he can solve everyone's problems. I stay in the shallow end of the pain pool, he says. I've written on the site that I specialize in mild life problems, like if you've had a breakup, a major career decision, or a midlife crisis. I'm your guy. I get questions from people who are schizophrenic or bipolar, and I'm like, hey man, I'm not qualified for this. And I give them resources, links, and phone numbers for people who are. I ask Manson why his strategy of setting himself up as the counterpoint to bullshit might make his work particularly appealing to men. He speculates that the internet has made people more skeptical, even a little bit paranoid, because we are exposed to so much information and we are aware of the ugly underside of a lot of things. When you're able to stand up and be like, this group is bullshit and here's why, that generates a lot of attention, he says. Men, he suggests, have always had the desire to improve themselves in their relationships, but they sensed the self-help industry's phoniness. It just felt bullshitty to them. My criticisms, I think, just put words to what a lot of them felt. I hear that all the time, too, actually. I never liked self-help stuff, and I didn't know why until I read your book. After The Subtle Art took off, Manson had a brief existential crisis. He wanted to keep writing books, but he knew any would be unlikely to outsell that one. He was grappling with a quandary that faces a disruptor of any major industry, from mattresses to happiness. Once you've popped the bubble, how do you keep growing? I think my whole career has been me kind of ascending within a genre or a community and then stepping out of it, kind of like moving on to something broader, he says. The same way when I was 27 or 28 that I said, I don't want to be writing about dating stuff the rest of my life. I don't want to be writing about self-help stuff the rest of my life. I feel there's a finite amount of things to say, and then once I say them, I just want to move on. There are writers in every genre, but particularly in self-help, who spend their entire careers rehashing the same material. Indeed, an occasional critique of The Subtle Art, which seems to rankle Manson, is that when you peel away his no-nonsense tone and his analysis of the industry, he isn't really saying anything new. I ask him whether he felt he was repeating his ideas while writing Everything Is F blank CKED. He concedes that some of the topics in the books are parallel, but says that Everything Is F blank CKED is the calculus to The Subtle Art's algebra, a more complex, nuanced version of the first book's simpler principles. Yet he is aware that there's only so much you can say about self-improvement and only so many different ways to say it before you start repeating yourself. Not that writing the same book over and over again is always bad, Manson adds, even hedging a criticism. Some people enjoy knowing that they're going to feel centered and motivated for the 5 hours it takes to read a book. I don't think it would have lasted this long or been this big if there wasn't some good that came from it, he says of the industry. I think the question is just, what is it? And my argument is that it's most self-help material is really just designed to make you feel good. While Manson's books may not be fluff, readers up with the promise of the bounty of the universe, like The Secret, or arm us with easy tricks for getting what we want, like The Game, they are designed to make us feel good. Nothing makes us feel better than being wise to a scam. And there's a little sidebar here. It says, some other self-helpers you should give a F blank a CK about. First of all, it says Kristen Meisner, M-E-I-N-Z-E-R, co-host of the podcast By the Book, distinguishes the new men in the betterment space. All right, here's number one is Meek Wiking. Longing for a bit of money, joy, and comfort in your life? There's no better source than the man who runs the Happiness Research Institute in Denmark and made H-Y-G-G-E, Hygie, a household word. Check out the little book of Hygie. Number two is Shad Helmstetter, Ph.D. Helmstetter is the dad voice we all deserve to hear in our heads. His message, be a little kinder to yourself. He lays out his methods in his primer, what to say when you talk to yourself. Third one is Ibram X. Kendi. Want to face and fight your own biases, better understand race in America, and contribute to making our society a more equitable place? Dive into How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is part memoir, part guide. Fourth one is Jonathan Van Ness. Van Ness's message isn't about telling people they're flawed, but rather embracing and loving who they are. Catch him on Queer Eye, on his podcast, or in his new book, Over the Top, A Raw Journey to Self-Love. And finally, number five is John Gottman, Ph.D. Gottman can famously predict whether a couple will stay together after meeting them for just a few minutes. Learn how and apply his wisdom for yourself with the 7 principles for making marriage work. All right, that article was titled Superstar, The Shady Past and Bright Future of Self-Help's New Superstar, and that was about Mark Manson. It was put together by Lauren Larson, and Lauren Larson lives in Brooklyn and is a men's health contributing editor, and of that it was, of course, from the Men's Health magazine. All right, back to GQ. We go to the fix. Labels we love. Why stylish runners all sweat District Vision. A runner and a yogi with a fashion credentials joined forces to create a workout gear brand for style-minded athletes. District Vision does not traffic in the hybridized world of athleisure. No co-founders Max Vallow and Tom Daly are into performance. They launched the brand in 2015 with precision-engineered sunglasses and have since released a range of technical apparel for runners. DV is for athletes, not athleisures. But don't blame Vallow and Daly if you buy a pair of their frames to wear while training for a triathlon and can't stop wearing them once you're done with your workout. As might be expected, before starting District Vision, both men had careers in fashion marketing. Daly was working at Acne Studios, Vallow at Saint Laurent. But when hard work and a heavy nightlife regimen caught up with them, Daly explains, it prompted some reassessment. The results were a newfound commitment to running for Daly and meditation for Vallow. They were also both really into Japanese-made eyewear and felt that the market lacked the styles they wanted to wear. It seemed no other interesting runner was excited about any sports eyewear, Vallow says. We felt sports eyewear could use some love, love they could provide for the first pair, squarish frames that look fast but not Tour de France fast. They hit on a few key features: an adjustable hypoallergenic nose pad, titanium core temples, oil and water resistant lenses. They applied those to the shapes that came next: high fashion blades built for speed, 70s inspired aviators, and raver meets alpinist ovals. Now all are stocked at high fashion emporiums like Dover Street Market and Essence rather than traditional sporting goods stores. The duo didn't plan to get back into clothing, but eventually they couldn't help themselves. They developed Airwear, a mesh that appears solid but reveals thousands of holes when stretched, a mid-layer program along with a grip of fashion and sports collaborations is on deck. It's all meant to fit seamlessly into the District Vision world. Somewhere at this intersection of sports and mindfulness, as Vallow puts it. So when I found myself training for a marathon last summer, DV was my first stop. The race was back in October, and my mileage has since dropped considerably, but I don't wear my sunglasses any less. And that article from the GQ magazine was titled Why Stylish Runners All Sweat District Vision. That was put together by Sam Shube. From the Men's Journal, we have the notebook section. We go to the travel section. It says, The Getaway, Italy's Alpine Retreat. The Dolomite Mountains' newest lodge is a high country oasis that merges mountain adventures with Italian chill. This is put together by Ryan Crow. South Tyrol, 2.5 hours north of Venice, couldn't be more different from the canal-cluttered tourist capital. Lying on the border with Austria, this Italian province feels far more like Cliffhanger than under the Tuscan sun, with alpine villages in the shadow of jagged peaks, and the area's newest hotel, Adler Lodge Ritten, which opened this summer, is closer to Scandinavia than the beautiful country. 20 chalets overlook a small lake surrounded by beech and pine trees. Each is outfitted with a wood stove and sauna, and waking up in the ebony-paneled interiors feels as if you're rising from a nap at a high-end spa. There's hiking and biking out the front door, and more adventurous activities like hang gliding and traversing one of the Dolomites' iconic Via Ferrata climbing routes. The food leans Austrian, smoked ham ravioli, braised veal with dumplings, and apple strudel. And Chef Hans Pignatter gets his inspiration, he says, by visiting local farms each week and selecting the best vegetables and cheeses. And he does it all over a glass of wine or two. He recommends you do the same. This is still Italy, after all. And that article was titled Italy's Alpine Retreat, put together by Ryan Crow, and that was from the Men's Journal magazine. That will conclude today's readings of Men's Magazines. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona broadcaster Philip Vrell, and join me next week for another edition of Men's Magazines. Have a great week. Stay tuned for further great programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.